Yeah.
All right, so let's begin by greeting everyone. I'll start out on with the Cloud Sangha, and the Dirt Sangha can introduce themselves. So, Bob. Betty.
Betty.
Ellen.
Ellen.
Paulette.
Paulette.
Yeshe Tsoki.
Yeshe Tsoki.
Jeff.
Jeff.
Jim.
Jim.
Marv.
Marv.
Susan.
Susan.
Karen.
Karen.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
Zoom user.
Zoom user.
Mick.
Mick.
Dave.
Dave. Dave.
Sabrina.
Sabrina.
Joshua.
Joshua.
Shalena.
Shalena.
Tracy.
Tracy.
And Ruth Ann.
Ruth Ann.
And your postage stamp sized. Zoom user. I can't quite tell. So anyway,
and then the Nizendo.
Dennis.
Dennis.
Jinryu.
Jinryu.
Domio.
Domio.
Erica.
Erica.
Joan.
Joan.
Andrew.
Andrew. Andrew.
Coral.
Coral. And Mark.
Mark.
All right. So there's not too much in terms of announcements, I guess, except Sunday is Zoom. Is Jukai. which is also accessible on Zoom. So we'll have five preceptees in the Dirt Zendo and five preceptees in the Cloud Zendo. So please come witness. Let's see. Oh, yeah. In Friday's newsletter, there will be something about this, but in the month of June, it'll be a little short series, Tuesday series. I will actually be out of town for one of the Tuesdays, and Tyler will be leading the class and discussion instead. But the three Tuesdays I will be leading it in Zoom in June. What is it with Zoom tonight? Anyway, in June, I decided to make it on No Self and focus on the relatively new book, No Self, No Problem. And so there'll be information on the website and on the newsletter about that. It's basically, what is it? It's modern understanding of the brain basically catches up to Buddhism. So it's a very interesting, research and modern psychology and how it has basically verified what Buddhism has been saying all along about the self. We'll be exploring that. So there'll be information in the newsletter and on the website about that. It's not like we have time to really read the whole book together, but if you did want to read the book and you just kind of read it over the course of the month, that might be a really interesting way. But I'll, of course, just make the classes accessible no matter where you are in the book or if you're reading the book. And then I came up with a term for our month of July, which I'm saying it's the Sangha Voices series, because the Tuesdays and Sundays will both be the classes and the talks will be led by Sangha members. And so it'll be an interesting mix of way-seeking mind talks and topics that certain people have just, been thinking about for a while and they want to share, and another one that's just going to be like a facilitated, discussion. So you kind of never know, who is going to be leading and what's going to be happening. So, please, we're all doing summer stuff, but numbers tend to be a little smaller, but show up in order to get to know your Sangha members better. Yeah. And there is one slot still open, but I'm tapping people one at a time to like, how about you?
And dates are flexible. If you can't do that particular date, we can figure out a way to, you know, take somebody else's slot.
Okay, so Jinri says she's taking care of the scheduling of that, and that it could be a little flexible in terms of switching dates if you're. All right, I think there's probably something more, but I think that's it. Any questions or other things that I should mention? All right, turn it back over to Mark.
We didn't know what was going to happen there. So welcome to the final precept class for our precept study season in 2022. Tonight's precept is do not defame the three treasures, respect the Buddha, unfold the Dharma, nourish the Sangha. And I'd like to start with kind of an appreciation of the Kyoji Kaimon text. This talk is full of ironies. I get very tired of chanting this thing by the end. And yet it does have a beautiful structure to it because it kind of mimics our own journey through the life of practice. Right? It starts out with the same way we start out, with this sort of sense of it can't go on like this, that comes out of our own suffering. And so it starts with that karma verse, you know, that past and harmful karma we fully avow. And it moves on into the three refuges, which is sort of, you know, express this sort of hazy intuition that there is a way or a truth that liberates, that there's cause for hope. And then we move into the three pure precepts, cease from evil, do only good, do good for others. And there it kind of acquires a sense of direction, but it's still a very vague direction, right? It's like a North Star for our practice. And you can navigate by the North Star, but you better be trying to hit something the size of a continent. And then you get to the 10 grave precepts, and they're very practical and they're very actionable. 10 specific classes of error that express one singular root of dualistic clinging. And of course, 10 is nothing but a nice round number. So, you know, we expand them through investigation and study. We turn them this way, turn them that way, apply them to different parts of our life. Does the pattern match? And here at the end of the 10, we come back round to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right? And I like that because it seems to me that the journey through the life of practice is not teleological. It's not a line, it's a spiral. You go round and round and deeper and clearer and clearer. And here, now sort of viewed from above, we've come back around to 12 o'clock high with this respect the Buddha, unfold the Dharma, nourish the Sangha, which is as compact and elegant a description of what it means to practice as anything I've seen. Now, I really didn't always feel that way about this precept. The first time I heard this precept, I was much, much cooler on the idea of becoming a religious person again. And so I probably rolled my eyes pretty hard at this, right? Like, hey, your religion says it's super, super important to respect your religion. Uh-huh. Got it. In fact, when I came to Bright Way, it was for a secular Zen and mindfulness course, and our pal Shakyamuni Buddha here wasn't even on display. One of our folding screens was in front of him. So it's kind of wild that I would be offering this class all these years later. Like I said, the first time I heard this precept, it just didn't mean anything to me, right? It was just cartilage, right? And it wasn't until I saw Domio render it as not disparaging aspiration in her book, Idiot's Guide to Zen Living, that it started to open up for me and started to get a sense for what it was. And even then, and even now, I struggle to connect to a lot of the writings on this. Now, last week, someone paid me a very lovely compliment about the precept class I did last year. So I went and I opened up my notes, and it's like 10 pages worth of exhaustively researched stuff, right? I haven't been able to do that with this one. For one thing, none of the writing on this one really speaks to me, although I appreciate Aitken Roshi's writing on this more and more. Eshin Rosetto doesn't have a chapter on this in Waking Up to What You Do. So what I'm doing tonight is different, and it's lighter, and it's just sort of a notebook of my wrangling with this precept. And maybe that'll be useful to you, maybe it won't be useful to you. And in any case, I'll at least have role-modeled tackling it on the trust that there's something there, even in the parts of the tradition that don't necessarily draw us. So we'll start out with the pragmatic. It's easy, right? I get a lot from imagining these precepts in action in the monastic context in which they were conceived of originally. So, you know, imagine yourself an ordained monk in a Buddhist monastery in ancient China. There are sects and lineages and traditions aplenty, right? You have these Tiantai guys who say the Lotus Sutra is the queen of Mahayana sutras. You have the Huayan guys who say, look, the Avatamsaka Sutra is clearly far thicker. You have Pure Land Buddhists chanting the Nyanfo to honor Maitreya Buddha day and night, pure devotion. You have these wall-gazing Chan weirdos, who, if you can get them to say anything at all, talk about a separate transmission outside the scriptures altogether. And that's just Mahayana Buddhism that sets aside completely these two giant branches of Buddhism, the Theravada and Vajrayana traditions. So, and those have, you know, untold sects and divisions of their own. So branches on branches on branches, you know, endless Buddhisms is the shape of Buddhism itself. So what is the trunk that ties it all together, if not Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right? The practical aspects of these traditions can be so completely different, and their scriptural traditions can be so completely different, that in a lot of cases, this guy is the biggest thing that we have in common with some of our cousins. And so that's one reason to respect the Buddha, unfold the Dharma, nourish the Sangha, or to not disparage the three treasures, because most of the people within the sound of my voice are Americans, and we know, unfortunately, all too well what it looks like when you start hacking away at the sense of commonality that ties it all together. So, beyond that, although there's a tendency to idealize monks and monastic practice, especially when they're safely lost centuries in the past, we can assume that there was probably lots of circumstances that led a person to being a monk, and probably a huge range in, let's say, actually wanting to be there in any given monastery, or at least of intensity of practice. You can imagine how it would be for some painfully earnest young monk like, say, our boy Dogen, to go to a practice place where the forms and traditions weren't being upheld, where the discipline was lax, where people were arguing about dogma instead of practicing, or in general, you might have even gotten the sense that some of these guys are in it for the rice, right? And well, I said we were all refining a hazy intuition. Would you continue to refine an intuition that brought you to a place like that, or would you let it languish and lose heart? So to a certain extent, that applies even now in a lay sangha like ours. More irony, as much as I dislike form, you know, when we enter the zendo, we bow in gassho, and we bow two more times before we take our seats, and that's as important as anything else we do, right? Our zazen sits on top of that gassho the same way that we sit on top of a cushion. Because the way that we hold the space and the way that we act in the training hall sets the tone for our own refining of that hazy intuition and everyone else's. So, you know, there's a certain amount of irony for that, for me to be saying that, because form generally annoys me. The first time I walked into this Zendo, I had my shoes on. And I'm coming back to the Zendo after a couple of years away and having to dust off dimly remembered forms that I haven't had anything to do with in 2 years because I don't keep them when I'm practicing at home. So part of this is me encouraging myself to get back to that sense of formality and determination. And the same thing applies out in the world, right? Koshin Paley Ellison touches on this in his book Wholehearted, that actually living up to our aspirations is how we don't defame the three treasures. We say often that each precept contains all the others, but in that way, this one is the most obvious, right? Keeping the precepts in general is not disparaging aspiration in particular and not defaming the triple treasure in particular. For people out there at the "it can't go on like this" stage of hazy intuition, the way that our practice has touched us can be the proof that no, it doesn't have to go on quite like this. That spiritual practice matters and things like the triple treasure aren't just comforting ideas to cling to like a raft in a storm. So, I said a bit before about how not defaming the triple treasure is in part how we avoid sectarian division with other Buddhists. This turns out to apply in a fairly universal way as well. Sherry Huber renders this precept as not to disparage this or any other religion. And that's a tough one, especially in a time and place where religion is waning in general, and some practitioners of the majority religion are going through a period of renewed interest in co-opting the power of the state. So, on what grounds could we, as Dogen advises, criticize nothing except everything? You know, for one thing, we can look at what happens when we don't. In a sense, that's exactly what we're being shown by today's troubling trends in religion. Right? Accept nothing, criticize everything hasn't exactly been a healthy direction for our society, has it? And yet that's still sort of unsatisfying, right? There's still something there. And I'll tell a story. A few years back, I was at our annual session, and Domio was giving instructions for silent work practice. And one of the things she said is, you know, you might see someone not following the instructions or doing something the wrong way, and you might be tempted to go over there and help them out and explain things, which would break the silent work period. And she said, as much as possible, trust the other person's practice. And, you know, it's funny how the little bits of incidental dharma are the stuff that stays with you sometimes, because that's been a guidepost for me in a lot of ways since. As much as possible, trust the other person's practice. But what if they're doing it really, really wrong? Like super wrong. But, of course, criticize nothing except everything doesn't mean not responding when harm is being done. But just as when we look back to the triple treasure, all those sectarian divisions in Buddhism fall away. When we look back to the human condition as the basis for all religious aspiration, and the universality of that human condition, then the rest of the sectarian divisions fall away as well. So when we respond, even if we have to respond in confrontation as bodhisattvas, to what extent can we respond from that trust in what is universal? Because if we don't, isn't that just more sectarian persecution? In a world where that's so commonplace as to bring religion itself into disrepute. If we don't, aren't we furthering the defamation of the triple treasure in the even bigger sense of religious aspiration in general? So let's take a look at the positive form of the precept too. Respect the Buddha, unfold the Dharma, nourish the Sangha. Like, respect can be a problem word for some of us. I know it is for me, especially if we come from a religious or cultural background where respect is a euphemism for submission to power or knowing your place in a hierarchy, considering the people who want you to know your place in a hierarchy usually think that place is the bottom. If that's where you're coming from, respect the Buddha could be fighting words, right? But of course, that's not what respect really means. Respect in its most literal sense just means to look again. I'm not the first or even the dozenth person to point that out, but that really is the key, looking again. Look again, look closer. Look past all the ideas we're so sure of. The precepts actually get more subtle as they go, right? The first five are a list of spectacularly bad ideas, right? I killed this guy and stole his whiskey, let's get drunk and screw. That is not a movie with a happy ending, right? But as you get towards the end, things get more subtle, right? Stinginess or withholding dharma or wealth, or withholding wealth at least, can feel like protecting yourself, looking out for yourself, when it's not like anybody else does that on a regular basis, is it? And anger can actually feel really refreshing and empowering, especially after a long period of suppression. But, you know, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, surely that idea is beyond reproach, right? That one's doing the work of the angels. Bodhidharma says maybe not so much, right? This is in the realm of the one, holding no concept of ordinary beings and sages is the precept of not defaming the three treasures. Holding a concept is the opposite of respect here. One of the things I love about Zen is that Zen words don't leave a residue behind for you to hold on to. No sacred ideas, no notions clung to, even in a quiet inward way. In fact, we have this tradition of Dharma combat and face-to-face interview with the teachers to test for that kind of thing. But as soon as we conceive of a Buddha or a sage as existing, ordinary beings are conceived of as well, if only to distinguish from the sage. So Bodhidharma sets this very high bar for us and suggests that true respect for the Buddha obliges us to relinquish even the idea of Buddha. So tonight, in that spirit, I've put one of our Buddha statues out in the audience. We put him on the altar, and we bow, and we offer incense, and chant, and prostrate, and that can be one way of showing respect, and refusing to do so can be part of defaming the triple treasure. But if we strand him up here in the high place, someplace else, someplace far away, that's another way of just hiding behind your ideas, right? Saying that the Buddha can't be just this, can't be just in this moment. And because our ideas, when we cling to them, are comforting in a way, it's one less thing to worry about. This kind of thing is insidious. He gets it. She gets it. He doesn't get it. She doesn't get it. They, the ever ominous they, just don't get it. I don't get it. Notice to say that I don't say I get it. Usually when we conceive of a Buddha, it's ourselves we're putting in the role of the ordinary being, right? Maybe that guy's the Buddha, but nobody else, and certainly not me, right? Below heaven and above earth, I alone am the world dishonored one. A lot of people out there carrying that karma around. And in the deepest respect, we step calmly past all of that all at once. I've said before that the view I have of Zen and Zazen changes on a regular basis. Today, I would say Zazen is a traditional form in which the utmost respect is practiced. Maybe tomorrow I'll be back to thinking it's an art form or renunciation or the end of alienation. Maybe the day after that I'll think it's an breakfast burrito with extra hot sauce. I don't know. It moves. And this precept exhorts us to unfold the Dharma, and I have a little gimmick for that too. It's the last one of the evening, I promise. When we say Dharma, meaning either the phenomenal world or the teachings that expound the nature of that phenomenal world, and we speak of unfolding that Dharma, I think of origami. Now, I can hold up my crane here, and I know that in traditional origami, you fold your model out of one sheet of paper. But looking at the shape, I don't see how that could possibly be so. It's too complicated. I'm cheating. I folded it. so I begin to unfold it. And things begin to appear. Little bits of structure start to show up. Start to get a sense for how it's put together. You fumble fingered because you're nervous. And you unfold it and unfold it and unfold it. And at the end, your whole sheet of paper appears. And yet, in all that unfolding and revealing fullness, the crane itself has never been lost. I said before that Zen words leave no residue behind. To look again reveals the not-two-ness, or not-differentness of phenomena. To unfold those phenomena fully reveals that no amount of unfolding turns the crane into anything but a crane. And the not-sameness of phenomena remains. So these two ideas, you know, they're unsatisfying in a way. We want an answer. I want an answer. And we get this unresolvable contradiction. But really, these two modes are cleaning up after each other so that neither leaves a residue behind, an idea to cling to. So when there's no sacred and no mundane and no ordinary beings and no sages and no outsiders, no insiders, no dualistic opposites at all, how could there be anything left but the harmony that is itself the Sangha treasure? So, you know, this respect the Buddha, unfold the Dharma, nourish the Sangha, it's not three things to me. It's three descriptions of the life of practice, as I said before. I think if you could keep this one precept truly, the other 15 would come along for free. So that's actually the extent of my talk. I'll open it up for questions and comments now, either on this precept or on the precepts in general. If things stall out, I have some prompts that I can needle you with, but that hardly ever happens. Janet?
Can we just ask it from here? Nobody will hear you and or see you. Matter of fact, even closer to the microphone.
Well, I just need some clarity. I don't understand what I'm hearing when you say words to the effect, and I don't even know if I've gotten right, that the Dharma doesn't leave any trace. I mean, can you explain that to me a little bit more? Because I have a reaction to it that is personal. That makes me want to disagree.
Sure.
Mark, can you repeat the question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I should have said that.
I have no idea what the question is.
I'm sorry. I should have said that. I can't remember the with my mask on. I can't remember the exact words, but Mark said several times about the Dharma or the teaching or the whatever leaving no trace. And so I'm asking for more of a description of what that means and more clarification, because I have a personal reaction that makes me want to disagree.
Maybe that's the right place to start. What trace do you think the Dharma leaves?
Well, in me, it's in my head. It's in my memory. I mean, you mentioned a teaching that has stuck with you for a very long time. To me, that's a trace. There are several teachings. I mean, there's one that I cling to. I find it so wonderful. But there are things I have learned here from my very first year here that are so much a part of me now. So for me to consider that they don't leave a trace doesn't make sense to me. So I don't know if that's exactly what you're saying.
I mean, how to put it? When we mistaken idea for something concrete, something that really exists and is not a situation. That's the kind of trace I'm saying the Dharma doesn't leave. That when all of the ideas about the Dharma have exhausted themselves and contradicted each other out of existence, you're still left with something, but it's a mystery as to what it is, right? This that we call life or the world or the universe or the mind. You can hang any number of words or ideas on it, but none of them fully capture it.
Okay.
And so that's the no trace, I mean. Mm-hmm. Certainly, as an ordinary being, I pick things up all the time. There is skill, there is how we are in the world.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe I should have
Oh, Mark.
Hey, Ruth Ann.
I'd like to share a couple of thoughts. I think in pictures, and to me, your talk tonight, I thought you said leaves no residue, and that's just what I heard. And to me, the word residue means stuff I don't want to leave behind. So when I hear do no harm, to me that's crystal clear, not in terms of how, but just a directive, a vow to kind of hang on to. So residue, like oil dripping from the vehicle, you don't want oil to be dripping from there. As I said, I heard residue. And I want to share briefly that to me, respect the Buddha. To me, I use the word reverence in whatever picture that holds for anybody. But also, when I see the image of unfold the Dharma to me is lessons around the corner, lessons we don't know we are in or open to. And I picture a folded, correctly folded sari, or like an American flag. So you have no idea of its worth, the flag or the sari, its beauty, until you unfold it, open it to what is revealed. So thank you for letting me share those picture words.
Thank you. My Mick raised hand. Go for it, Mick.
Yeah, I really like the notion of words not leaving a residue. And it reminded me, I'm going to forget the author, but I was reading a book and he was talking about Dogen, in particular, the kind of like verbal gymnastics that Dogen does, the way he kind of like throws words around to like, to study the self is to forget the self, to forget the self is to be like actualized by all things. Like, and he was saying that the point of the words are to literally like blow around the stuff in your mind and kind of like clear the dust, the way that we kind of settle into the relative world. And you read these texts that just, the purpose of the words isn't to settle in and to be another idea. It's to kind of like literally get scrambled around in your mind and kind of clear out some of those cobwebs. And when you kept saying that they don't leave a residue, that's kind of the thing that popped into my mind. It's the purpose isn't to leave a residue, it's to clear out other residues, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, the relative and the absolute clean up after each other. And I can never, should I misquote it or not bother? All right, I will quote the one from Huangbo, because I can't remember the one from The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines. But Huangbo said that the compassion of a bodhisattva is called great compassion because it does not conceive of beings to be saved. And that idea that that our response can be so natural that it doesn't depend on objects at all, to me, reminds me of that utmost respect, where we're looking past everything we think and just responding. Did I miss one? Oh, Paulette. Yep. Sorry, everybody is very small on my screen, so go for it, Paulette.
It just reminded me of the, you know, Prajnaparamita, which is the emptiness is form and form is emptiness. It's like one, you know, one kind of, I don't think it cancels out the other one, but it sort of completes the other side. So that's, when you were talking about that, that's what came to my mind.
So I don't mean to set the tone for the evening to be talking about the relative and the absolute. That's just what I take away from that second half of the precept.
I've got a gritty take on it. So this isn't as, I mean, there's so many levels to the precepts. So this is the real, it's a little more gritty experience of this that feels a little more like the other precepts. And that is another way that I've heard this put, and that I put it for myself, is do not blame the three treasures. Because, especially after years of practice, it becomes easy to blame Buddhism or the Dharma or especially the Sangha for the fact that you have not achieved the peace that you would like, whether you are, that's particularly within the context of Sangha. You know, I guess for me it manifested a lot when I was a monk and I was, you know, if only I was at a different Zen center, if I was in a monastery, if I had a different teacher, if I did a different Sangha, you know, then all would be well, which of course, you know, is a complete delusion. But there's, there can be a real point in practice where you really do, many people have had difficult experiences with various teachers and sanghas, and they can get really bitter and turned off to Buddhism and go around, and that's what I feel like, really disparaging aspiration in a way. You can become really hard and bitter and cynical because of past harms, and then basically just go around, you know, disparaging everybody's devotion or whatever, whether it's Buddhism or not. So anyway, just throw that out there.
I encountered an author online once, and I enjoyed this author's work, and at some point he said something to the effect of, change is the only constant, parenthesis. This is the thing the Buddhists keep hiding. And it was kind of like, but, you know, there's that moment where I feel like there's a way you can look at the teachings of Buddhism and say, like, this is all just a lot of filigree on something that's very basic and very human. So I'll ask the room, does that sound like defaming the three treasures or not?
Does what sound like?
That moment where you're like, this is all actually not all that complicated. There's a whole lot of brocade and teachings and sutras to say that everything changes and we have to deal with it.
I think it's missing a lot. It's a little more complicated than that. Maybe not by much. Maybe we overcomplicate it with all the things we study, but it's got a couple of more layers than that.
Well, I think there's, to poke a hole in my own question, there's a world of difference between intellectually saying change is the only constant, which everybody knows, and being all right living with change is the only constant. So are there other practical applications here? I thought I'd start a fire by pointing out the sectarian divisions. I certainly find it difficult to remember what is underneath faiths that I currently find frustrating. That takes a bit of doing.
What is underneath what?
Other faiths. I read I didn't manage to work a quote from him into the talk because he is extremely hard to read, but I read a wonderful book by Paul Tillich called The Courage to Be. And one of the things that he was a Christian theologian, and one of the things he explored at great length is essentially the idea that religion exists to help us deal with the anxiety of knowing how small we are and how limited.
Can you elaborate on that?
As soon as you conceive of an I and a self, there's an extent of that self, right? This one is 6 foot tall and about 6 foot wide, if he tries. And everything that's outside of that is other, right? So as soon as you think of yourself and you look at this giant, giant universe, you're unbearably small, right? You're a mote of dust. And you're depending on all these things outside of yourself. You have no choice in the matter. And one day, something you need won't show up, and that will be the end of you, right? So there's this innate anxiety to being a person, and I think that's the place that all religions come from, however they choose to deal with it, to lift your sight to something bigger so that you can put yourself into context. Now I'm trying to decide if that was defaming the three treasures.
Coral, I'll let you announce when there's somebody with their hand raised.
Oh, looks like Yeshe's got her hand up.
No, thank you. Go for it, Yeshe.
Just in response to what you said, I couldn't help but think about people who use religion very, very literally as a weapon and a way to weaponize themselves. So in a sense, it's not promoting change, but being used to maintain a fixed position.
Yeah. The quote from Father Tillich that I would have worked in here, I would summarize as religious zealotry comes from turning your religion into submission to power, and therefore when you secure yourself against life's anxiety by submitting to an authority, it is bothersome that others do not submit to the authority, because that weakens your own ability to deal with your anxiety by saying, I've got this handled. And I love that section. Unfortunately, it's about a page and a half of very academic writing to say, essentially, this is what happens when you hang on to a sacred idea. And you reify some sacred idea. Others have to conform to it. And that's one of the reasons why I love the fact that Zen words delete themselves.
I like that, what you just said, that Zen words delete themselves. I like that.
Paulette?
I don't want to take us off topic, but I often thought that religion was more of a way for people to deal with their own death. You know, like fear of their own death and what happens. And I don't know, maybe that is in some ways my, you know, I know that a lot of people here don't, but I believe in like multiple lives. So maybe in some ways, you know, things don't go as planned, I got another chance, you know, kind of thing. But I liked what you said about the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha being kind of one and the same, because I think that's a really beautiful way to look at it. It's very poetic. And I, you know, this one is a tough one. I appreciate, you know, some of the things that you've brought up. Some of them are a little heady, but I appreciate the, you know, the ideas and the ability to provoke thought. Thank you.
Yeah, the problem with offering a personal notebook of my dealing with this precept is it isn't necessarily a thing that you can export to other people. You have an applicability problem. So then that's actually a great point and a great turn we could take. How do you wrangle with this precept? For those of you that wrangle with this precept.
I'll go ahead and jump in, I guess. This is kind of I don't even know if this is like an appropriate way of juggling with it, but I think a lot of times, like, it's just human nature. You interact with somebody and you just like, oh, that's Laura. I work with her. She's this person. And you kind of just like, I mean, to me, right? Like, everyone's Buddha nature is there for you to see and to witness. And when you just kind of like write them off as these sort of like bit players in your film, I've kind of taken that to be disparaging the Buddha treasure, right? Like it's there everywhere. And I'm willfully closing people off, so that my narrative world makes sense to me.
Yeah. I get a lot of use out of remembering that everybody else has struggled to get to where they are in their life, wherever that is, same as me.
I can say something unless somebody's waiting.
Someone waving? I don't see anybody waving.
Well, if I remember correctly, your question was how do we
wrestle with this precept ourselves?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that. And when you said, you know, it's really all about respecting the Buddha or however you put it. I do think of it as three things, and maybe that's because on Sundays we say three refuges prayer. So I don't know what thoughts you had in preparing for this talk about this precept and or the three refuges prayer. But as Dominion knows, I like things in threes. And you know, the three refuges prayer for me is just a recipe for this is how I'm supposed to practice. I have to do these three things. And there have been many times when I've wanted to do something or not wanted to do something, and I wondered, which is the best way to go in order to nourish this, you know, what, I take refuge in Sangha, may all beings support harmony in the community. So do you have any thoughts on that? Three refuges prayer versus this precept.
Well, so you're saying that the three refuges feel like three different things.
Well, I'm saying that if you ask me how I work this precept or whatever your question was, I would say I do it through the three refuges prayer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So embody the great way of resolving to awaken, deeply enter the sutras, wisdom like an ocean, and nourish harmony in the community free from hindrance.
Yeah. That's what I do.
So I'm new to this precept. I have no opinion on it, really. But I just, you know, the idea of, like, the only constant is change. I actually don't really think that's true, because I think if you look at human history, we just keep going through the same things over and over again. And so I think it's more accurate to say that the only constant is cycling through the same things over and over.
So. Okay. Thank you. I'm not gonna open the can of worms that is my third conversation prompt at 8:53.
Why not?
Well, why not?
It's a long time.
All right. So Dogen's comment on this precept, this is the one part of the text that I didn't manage to touch on, was to do something by ourselves without copying others is to become an example to the world. But of course, we copy examples. So what is the example to the world? What is the basis for our example to the world if we're not copying anyone? And how does that relate to respecting the Buddha, unfolding the Dharma, and nourishing the Sangha?
Mark, do you mind repeating that question?
Sure. Kind of made it up on the spot. To do something by ourselves without copying others is to become an example to the world. But of course, examples are meant to be copied. That's what we do with examples. We follow them. So if we do something by ourselves without copying others, what example are we offering to the world? And how does that relate to, let's call it the life of practice, because that's what I keep saying this, the positive form of this precept is.
Yes,
it's okay. Thank you, everybody who's watching the big screen, for keeping me honest. Go for it, Yeshe. You're muted? You're muted.
You can't hear me very well if I'm muted. I'm trying to just clarify the question. It seems what I'm hearing is that there's nothing original. Is that what you're, I'm not sure if that's what you're saying. I'm trying to figure out or discern, because that immediately comes to mind, well, what about a piece of music? What about a piece of artwork? What about a different story? What about the way you design your garden or something like that? I mean, does it have to be copied? I don't think that it has to be copied, and it could still be original.
Sure. My read on this is that the example we offer to the world by doing something by ourselves, is that authenticity. And then how does that authenticity relate to respecting the Buddha, unfolding the Dharma, and nourishing the Sangha, if those are a description of the religious life?
I think one of the things that comes up to me when, well, many things come up, but in terms of Buddhism, I would say putting aside anything that comes to you, Yana, from outside, that's in a way being manipulative or controlling, rather than what's really enabling you to truly penetrate your uniqueness and serve your uniqueness, so that what you are actually expressing is your unique gift or jewel that comes through your Buddhahood. I don't know if that was clear or mushy.
I mean, to me, it's in the last line, criticize nothing except everything.
How so?
I can't hear what someone just said.
Sort of apologize. I feel like I'm hogging the seat a little bit, but to me, what we're talking about is in the last line. So I hope people understand that what we're reading here is the Dogen part of the description of this precept. So the first paragraph under the precept is Bodhidharma. Second paragraph is Dogen. So the question comes around doing something that's really unique without copying others. And I can't remember how the rest of it goes. But to me, how you do that, how you be truly authentic, is by criticizing nothing and accepting everything. Mm. To me, that is a perfect description of the best experience I can have in the present moment.
So I have a hard time understanding. Can you repeat, Mark, what that person is saying? The person stand in a different place to make it more clear?
It's Jinryu, Yeshe Sogi.
Okay.
It's Jinryu. So what I'm saying is that this second paragraph that we're talking about is what Dogen says to describe this precept. The first paragraph is Bodhidharma, the second one is Dogen. And all I am saying is that, to me, the very last line, criticize nothing, accept everything, is, for me, if I can do that, that is the very best personal experience I can have in terms of practice, on or off the cushion. That's what I'm saying. Is that more clear?
Then you got a thumbs up.
You also said something to the effect of that was authenticity as far as you were concerned. Criticize nothing except everything.
I think it is.
It's also very, very respectful.
Yeah.
All right, so It's nine on the nose. Shall I offer the merit?
Yes.
Okay. We offer the merit of this precept class to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.
Thank you, Mark. It was really wonderful.
Was it?
Yes.